My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreyan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pyle and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
We go straight into round one, which tests their vocabularies. And for 2 marks, I want to know what the dictionary meaning is of the following words. Beginning with Frank Muir. Frank, miasma or miasma? I don't think much matters which. M-I-A-S-M-A.
It's rather like this program, is it not? It's a sort of poisonous something in the air.
Yes. Yeah, but not strictly verbal.
When the Romans went into places like Corsica, went into ports and settled on sort of lowland areas, which usually turned out to be riddled with mosquitoes and malaria. Mm-hmm. And from those swamps arose what was called a miasma,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which was a poisonous air.
And what did they think about the mosquitoes?
Well, they resented them.
It's all right, you get your 2 marks. The interesting thing is that they thought that the malaria was caused by these poisonous exhalations from a marsh or from putrescent organic matter or from poisonous germs floating about. And, of course, they were quite wrong. They didn't know that it was beastly mosquitoes which were causing the malaria. And malaria means the same thing. It means bad air. And that, again, is what miasma means. 2 marks. Anne Scott James. Empathy, like sympathy, but with an E-M in front of it.
These dreadful abstract words, as if one gets so bogged down in them. Well, it's rather like sympathy, isn't it?
Yes.
It's something to do with the feeling, that's the pathos part.
Yes.
It's something you feel within you.
About?
Right inside you. About? Well, let us say I've...
About 1.5 marks, isn't it?
Listen, I'm finished. I'm going to get that other half killed. Supposing you say I have a feeling deep inside me that Frank Muir is a terribly good chap, would that be an empathy?
No, I think it's called love.
I'm not going as far as that. Come on,
isn't empathy when you experience exactly the same feelings as somebody else is experiencing?
Yes.
Whereas if sympathy is when you can appreciate what they're feeling rather than actually experience them.
Well, you both love me.
Very risky.
I think we'll give you a 2 on that. It's the ability to project your personality into and therefore fully understand something else, the object of contemplation. Usually a person, needn't be, it might be a dog. But I think you get your 2 marks. And it's an odd word because it looks as if it comes straight from the Greek. It doesn't. The Germans, as they invented many psychological terms, invented this and they called it Einfühlung. And we put it back into Greek, which is exactly the same as what the German word means. 2 marks. Dennis Norden. A word I've always called hegemony, but I believe it can be called hegemony. But it's spelt H-E-G-E-M-O-N-Y. Hegemony.
Have you always called it
hegemony? Yeah.
Hegemony,
yes.
Yes, so did I.
I've never said it out loud. Minority of two.
Hegemony.
Yes, yes.
Oh, well, there you are. That's what makes horse racing. It's one of those kind of editorial type words. It's only used in editorial. And it's one of those ugly words, like most words about authority.
Yes.
Are. And as far as I can understand, I don't know about the dictionary meaning, but I've always understood it to be this sort of ruling element.
Yes.
In a situation. Like you're the hegemony on this program.
I wish I were.
And the miasma. I always say at the beginning of the program, with Jack Longland in the chair, as though we're all standing up.
True.
Instead of kneeling down.
Well, I think that's good enough, Dennis. It means leadership, as Dennis said, and especially the leadership of one state in a confederacy over the other states, as Athens was in classical times over a thing called the Achaean League, and it is a straight Greek word. Tell us, Powell, your word is idiumpty.
It could be just
I double D Y hyphen
I double D Y
hyphen U M T
U M U M T Y, no P.
Like Humpty Dumpty without the H.
It's the surname of Rumpelstiltskin. Rumpelstiltskin Idiumpty.
Idiumpty.
Sounds a perfectly good name to me.
No, it represents a method of communication. I'll help you that far.
Is it catching?
No, it's not catching.
Not a disease. Infectious disease.
Not a disease.
Not idiumpty, you know, vulgaris.
It's something that Dennis did quite a lot of the war.
Did he? He flew.
Oh, yes. It means Morse code.
Yes.
That's it?
Oh, yes. It's diddy-daddy, I was referred to it as.
Well,
he said.
Yes, that's
because,
right.
Because Dennis did Morse code during the war. He won the war for us.
That's right, he did.
So if anybody asks you, I won it with my idiumpty. In 4 years, I'd never heard Morse code till it's referred to as idiumpty. Anyway,
it's a
my
word. There's a whole
bunch of things. That's right, yes. Well, all the same, I gave a lot of help. I'm going to mark that 1.5 marks, and it is one, at any rate, of the conventional verbal representations of the dots and dashes in the Morse code. And I think the iddy is the dot and the umpty is the dash, but I may be wrong. Well, at this point, I give Dennis and Frank a quotation each to think about for their stories in the last round. And Dennis, yours is, "I'm dreaming of a white Christmas." And for you, Frank, "Beggars cannot be choosers."
Cool.
Well, now we have a round of classical catchphrases, and for one mark, I'd like to know in what classic play or novel the catchphrase appears, and for another mark, what was the name of the character who said it? Beginning again with Frank Muir. Frank, "Comparisons are odorous."
It's Shakespeare.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's a good start.
Starts or finish. No idea. On the other hand, the name Malvolio. Not Malvolio. When one says Malvolio, one doesn't mean Malvolio. Woman.
Bothering about very little.
Much Ado About Nothing.
Yes, that'll do.
Is the play,
yes,
by William Shakespeare.
Don't stop now, it's enough.
Oh. That's enough.
Do you want any more?
Yes, I did ask for a character.
Oh.
The character.
I can only think of Benedict and Beatrice. Much
Ado. And Arnold.
There's always a clown.
There's a local policeman.
Think of your...
There's always a clown in every film, and I...
Think of
your Afghan. Oh. What's your Afghan called,
Lady Ocelyne Mole. Doesn't seem relevant to where I sit. Dogwood.
Dogwood, or what?
Yes, I think you'll creep home on that one.
Yes, we knew it. We were just teasing you.
We were doing rather good.
A somewhat chancy 2 marks. And now, Anne Scott James, "I own the soft impeachment."
Over to you, Dennis.
Isn't it, what's her name? The woman who got things back to front.
That's right.
Mrs. Malaprop.
Yes. Oh. Fine. Have a shot at the player.
Mrs. Spooner.
In The Rivals.
Yes.
Sheridan.
Absolutely right. 2 marks. Mrs. Malaprop always got her quotation slightly wrong, and "I own the soft impeachment," or "a nice derangement of epitaphs" and things of that sort. 2 marks. Dennis Norden. "Them's my sentiments."
Yes, madam. Could you walk up here? "Them's my sentiments."
That's it.
Sounds like the owner of the first greetings card shop surveying his stock. Is it Dickens?
The other one.
The lady there knows.
The other one.
Thackeray.
Was that what you...
Well, have a shot at the lot.
Retreated now.
Pity.
It's not so easy when you have to actually sit here and say. I don't know.
Have a shot at the novel. It's
a novel?
Yes.
The Rose and the Ring?
No, novel.
Becky Sharp?
No. Oh, yes, in same... One and a half, a certain amount of assistance there. It is Fred Bullock in Thackeray's Vanity Fair, chapter 21. Now, to this power. When found, make a note of.
Dickens.
Yes.
In the... Is Captain Cuttle?
Yes.
Captain Cuttle in...
It's the... It's the motto of Notes and Queries, that marvellous magazine which has been running for 250 years.
It's one about the daughter who was despised by her father and then was loved by him and adored...
Dombey and Son, Dickens, and the character is Captain Cuttle, and he'd just been quoting from the Proverbs of Solomon, or so he said, "May we never want a friend in need, nor a bottle to give him. When found, make a note of." 2 marks. Well, now a round of household hints. They're fairly old household hints, though some of them may possibly be still valid. I'll leave you to judge. And they're remedies for the solution of various domestic difficulties. For 2 marks, what do you deduce to be the household problem for which the following is the traditional remedy? Frank Muir, first rub well with a little fresh butter and clean it off with a solution of rock ammonia dissolved in hot water, and then hold it under running water and wipe dry.
Well, that's a goodie, isn't it? Butter. If you rub butter into something, it's presumably grease already. No. Ammonia presumably is to bleach it, so it's a fabric.
Yes.
Hold.
Anyway, to clean it. The bleach, I think, would not help.
Wouldn't help. Why don't you put it in, then, if it doesn't help?
I didn't say bleach, you said bleach.
I think it's probably to... It's one of those ladies' book of household things of the early 19th century. And it's to remove falcon droppings from the knee of evening dress.
If the falcon was overhead...
Well, he usually is.
And misbehaving, might
have got that far. Falcon droppings...
Yes,
The knee of an evening dress suit.
Right overhead.
From your hair? From your wig?
No. You rub the butter into the wig.
Well, what do you have on your wig?
Hat.
Yes.
Powder.
From your hat.
Yes. Now, what kind of hat?
Billycock.
Yes, that's what I wanted.
Billycock.
Billycock hat.
Yep. It's how to clean the brim of a bowler hat. 2 marks.
With butter?
Yes, cleansed by rock ammonia.
Wow.
And you had to hold it under running water and then wipe dry. It's a pretty elaborate process. But we go on to Anne Scott James. Boil a fair-sized parsnip to a pulp, allow to cool slightly, and then apply.
Apply for what?
It must be a medicament, I should think.
Yes.
And I think that when you've got some enormous boil or abscess, which is the result of overeating, you make a compress and apply it.
You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
There'll be a run on fair-sized parsley.
It's two marks. It's how to reduce an abscess or a carbuncle.
We've had soft words, butter and parsnips.
Yes, well done. Now, Dennis Norton, take half a cupful of strong tea containing 2 tablespoonfuls of sugar. With this mixture, sponge well and leave open till dry.
Something that can open and close. Doesn't sound like part. Doesn't sound like your mouth or anything. A Gladstone bag.
It might work on that.
Clean the interior of a Gladstone bag.
It isn't, in fact.
An umbrella.
Yes.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
You're very good indeed.
Absolutely. I mean, every time I put my umbrella, you're probably aware.
Absolutely right. It's how to renovate a tarred umbrella. The tea revives the colour. I'm assuming it's a black one. And the sugar stiffens the fabric so it doesn't leak. 2 marks. Now, one for Dillis Powell. Now, I hope this won't be misunderstood, Dillis. Mix some oil of peppermint with hot water and pour it down the drains. Then go about the house smelling.
Well, I leave that to other to my visitors, really. Go round the house smelling. Well, I mean, it's to clear up the drains, which stank before, if I may use the word.
Yes, and how does the peppermint help?
Find the leaks.
Does it leak?
Find where the fracture of the pipe is, presumably.
Darling, Frank is... Frank is very good at household hints.
I know me
and
drains.
Frank frequently finds a leak in the drains by pouring oil of peppermint down it and going around smelling.
Yes. It's to find out whether there is a leak of sewer gas, which is not very smelly itself, and therefore adding the peppermint in... but it turns out this methane, which happens a bit later, I think. And the peppermint tells you, as Frank says, exactly where the pipe is fractured or where the leak is coming from. We now come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave Dennis and Frank at the beginning of the programme. And in this round, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Dennis, your quotation is, "I'm dreaming of a white Christmas," which is by Irving Berlin.
As far as Christmas is concerned, I happen to be in that peculiarly awkward position which you may sometimes have found yourself in. I've found out what I'm being given for Christmas, and I don't want it. Now, I mention this because I believe it defines a situation which, over the years, is happening to more and more people more and more frequently. Now, I know that the British Christmas isn't what it used to be, what with deep frozen turkeys and dirty Christmas cards and department stores that advertise three Santa Clauses, no waiting, and carol singers getting mugged for their pitch pipes, and Christmas trees being so expensive, the only one you can afford, you have to bend down to put the star on it. But that is not where the real Christmas rot, as it were, has set in. If anyone wants to know when Christmas stopped being Christmas, I'll tell them. It was when we stopped giving presents and started giving gifts, which come from gift shops. You know? A small porcelain figurine of a shepherdess with a barometer in her navel. Magnetized backgammon boards. Moroccan drink trays that have nothing that you can lift them up by. A Swiss brandy glass that hits the top of your nose when you tilt it to drink. Objects called pendants for hanging round your neck. Huge, irregularly shaped blobs of Swedish metal that are so heavy, every time you walk fast, it bumps chips off your sternum. See, these are gifts, as distinct from presents. The new giving objects, not designed for use or ornament or enjoyment, just sort of currency for Christmas transactions. And of all of them, the one that makes my heart really sink down to knee level is what I'm being given. A Scandinavian candle making kit. Now, I can just see the sequence of events when I open it, you know. Oh, it's a candle maker. Sure you haven't got one? No, I don't think so. Well, go on, try it. Let's see you try it. Do you know that particular muscular ache at the sides of your face that only comes from maintaining a grateful smile? You know that? That'll be me all Christmas Day. Moreover, what is more, with the particularly virulent form of cack-handedness that I happen to be afflicted with, I can just see what that candle making kit will lead to. All that wax and moulding and hot tallow. If anybody wants to know what I expect to be doing around about 6:30 on Christmas night, I can tell them now. I'm cleaning off a white grease mess.
Dennis may like to be reminded that Gift is the German word for poison. And now we go back to Frank's quotation, which is, beggars cannot be choosers, which is an old proverb.
I had this letter this morning from Mr. Hopcraft, and it was very harshly critical of my diction. And Mr. Hopcraft protested that I didn't pronounce my R's properly. He said, if you don't believe me, repeat aloud the following sentence. And the sentence in the letter read, round and round the rugged rocks, the ragged rascal ran. Don't see anything wrong with that. But this chap complained. He said that I sort of diminished the R sound, and that it should be a very loud and big sound, the sound that Shakespeare had with Romeo and Juliet and Richard II and Richard III and the two gentlemen of Verona, and it's got to be sort of big and powerful. And he said that the R is a very important sound quality in the English language, and it's it should be large and choice. And I was thinking about this. You know, I agree. My R's are not what they should be. I mean, it's got to be phased. They are a bit sort of muffled and mangled. I missed elocution at school. You know when you're at school that if you miss the first day of a subject, you never catch up the rest of your life. I missed the first day of English grammar. Mind you, it doesn't notice. I speak like what similar as ordinary people does. But I had three teeth removed during the lessons in elocution. Not only was I light on knowledge when I left school, but I was about 0.5 stone light in weight. But I just missed this business of elocution. And I agree that my R's are a little sort of muffled and small. But what I can test is the fact that because a thing is bigger, it's better. I'm getting vehement, aren't I? I just don't agree with that. The poetess who wrote, little drops of water, little grains of sand, make the mighty ocean and the pleasant land. How right she was. But what about big drops of water? What do you get? Floods, deluges, ruin, phone exchange deluged, areas such as mine cut off for 7 days. Little grains of sand, beautiful. What happens if you get large, bigger grains of sand? I'll give you an impression. See if you can guess what this is. It's a bather walking down Brighton Beach. Big grains of sand are pebbles, are they not? So bigger isn't necessary. And look at literature. I mean, Little Lord Fauntleroy. There was a lovely figure, wasn't he? But imagine lofty Lord Fauntleroy. Dearest, he says to his mother, oh, don't call me that, you great lout. She said, look at you, 6'2", bursting out of your velvet suit. You look like a prune stuck halfway down a knitting needle. Seems to even frighten the Great Dane. How are we going to get grandfather's money? Look at you with your long curl. You see, bigger isn't better, is it, Mr. Hopcroft? I mean, you and take things like Little Dolly Daydream, Pride of Idaho. Isn't it lovely? It's dancey and light. But you can't imagine Dumpy Dolly Daydream, Pride of Idaho. I mean, it kills it, doesn't it? Bigger isn't necessarily better, and particularly so with diction, particularly so with anything. I mean, if you take fruit, the choice fruit is surely the small fruit, isn't it? If you're having a prison sentence, I mean, the little or golf score or the size of a baby being born, it's small. There is a quality to smallness. So I say, Mr. Hopcroft, surely I've proved to you, you're absolutely wrong that bigger is better. I say that smaller is much better, and certainly to do with the letter R. Big R's cannot be choice R's.
Well, there was a series of pictures to frighten us at Christmas. And, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, and really I thought you were going to do better than this and make it possible to reach a decision, but Frank Muir and Dennis Norden have tied.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.